Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. I got my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski, super endocrinologist. And we're going to be talking today about the FLOW trial, which was a trial using Ozempic, but up to 1 milligram, not up to the 2 milligrams of semaglutide that we see now, as it was started back in the day when only 1 milligram was available, looking at some really interesting renal outcomes, kidney outcomes. This one just came out. We did talk about top line results a few weeks ago or months ago now, because Mark Hyman and a few other people have said these things cause kidney failure, when in fact they're actually renally or kidney protective. The top line results came out, but now we actually have the full study published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So we're going to talk about that today.
Some interesting things out of this, especially as I kind of read through more of the nuances and details. But I think, you know, people need a little bit of a background. The bottom line background is that obesity increases risk of kidney disease and heart disease. I think we've, you know, educated that pretty well. When you develop type 2 diabetes, in addition to obesity, you have a much higher risk of heart disease, dying of heart disease, kidney disease, progressing kidney disease, needing, you know, going to kidney failure, needing dialysis, and death from heart and kidney disease. And your heart and kidneys really work together. That's why, you know, you hear people talk about needing, you know, cardiorenal focus as we help people with obesity and these complications. And so the more severe the disease, the higher the risk of having events like heart attacks, strokes, progressing to kidney failure, and dying. And so over all the years, long before we were in school, there have been a lot of studies on how to help prevent these. So in type 2 diabetes specifically, or, you know, even type 1 diabetes, just having hyperglycemia increases the risk of what
high blood sugar.
Yeah, high blood sugar increases the risk of what we call microvascular complications, and specifically kidney disease. You know, it's the leading cause of blindness, and it's it, along with the high blood pressure that comes from obesity, by the way, is the leading cause of kidney disease. And when you have these things, your risks of heart attacks and dying of heart kidney disease are just, you know, they're just
tremendous.
That's a total inside joke. So anyways, that's why they study all these things. And we've had medications over the years that treat diabetes, blood pressure, et cetera, specifically, you know, kidney protective medications that are essentially standard of care. And then over the past essentially 10 years, it's kind of blown up with some of these new diabetes medications, showing that they reduce risk of heart attacks, strokes, death, and as it turns out, a significant relationship with the kidneys.
Kidneys. All right. So what did the trial show? What are the basics?
All right. So the basics. So these were patients with obesity and type 2 diabetes. They all had hemoglobin A1Cs of less than 10%. So for people out there with type 2 diabetes, you know where that kind of lands. Normal average sugars is an A1C of 5.6 or less. Pre-diabetes, 5.7 to 6.4. Usually our goal A1Cs for people with diabetes are 6.5, maybe 7 to 8, depending on the patient. But anyways, these were high-risk patients with obesity, type 2 diabetes, and they said they had high-risk chronic kidney disease. So that basically means their estimated filtration rate was between 25 and 75. And if you think people need to, you know, review what those categories are, basically, if your doctor says you have chronic kidney disease 3A to B or CKD4, that's where that would be fitting in. But they also had to have protein in their urine. And so if their that estimated filtration rate was a little bit better, like 50 to 75, they also had to have a urine albumin to creatinine ratio of 300 to 5,000. If it was below, if it was 25 to 50, which is kind of like CKD4 or CKD3B, then it actually still had to be between 100 and 5,000, had to be over 100. So it's a pretty sick population that this was testing, if that makes any sense to anybody listening.
Yeah, these people have kidney disease. For most people out there, if you don't have type 2 diabetes, you're probably not checking the protein in your urine. This is kind of a newer thing. We check it in those who have type 2 diabetes, but now it's becoming a newer recommendation to start checking it probably outside of type 2 diabetes. And it's another way to see like, oh, this person's like their filtration rate, like the GFR that my brother is talking about looks okay, but you might actually find they're spilling some protein. So I think it's good that they went above and beyond just the GFR.
Yeah, and when we look at these trials, I mean, we use these high risk populations because that's where you see the benefits of these significant medications the most. And I always tell patients the urine albumin to creatinine ratio, the little bit of protein in the urine, it's like a canary in the coal mine. Everything's working, but there's significant stress being put on the kidneys from all the things, the obesity, the high blood pressure, the diabetes, that whole system. So these patients also had to have essentially a maximum dose or at least max tolerated dose of the medications that are known to protect the kidneys and diabetes. And those are ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers. So classically known as lisinopril in the ACE inhibitor realm, anything that ends in pril, the medications that sound like losartan or telmisartan or valsartan, those are the ARBs. And so those have been shown to help protect kidneys in type 2 diabetes when people have high blood pressure, protein in the urine, et cetera.
And we'll get into this, but at the time, the SGLT2 inhibitors weren't used as much in this population.
Right. We'll get down to that for sure, because that's a big deal. That's your matzo ball right there. So the average characteristics of these patients, 67 years old, 30% were females. It was a global trial. So there was like 25% each from Asia, Europe, North America, and then other, but still 65% were listed as Caucasian, 25% Asian, 4.5% Black, 5% other, while 15% of those within that self-identified as Hispanic or Latino. The average hemoglobin A1C was 7.8%, so about 8%. So remember, our goals, depending on what the patient's characteristics are, usually, under 6.5, somewhere maybe, under 7, maybe 7 to 8 for older people. Diabetes duration was actually pretty long. So 44% of people had diabetes of less than 15 years since diagnosis. And obviously the rest had over 15 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah. And as far as splitting up the kidney degrees, so 29% had chronic kidney disease stage 3A. So that's a GFR, a filtration rate of 45 to 60. So that's when we really start talking about chronic kidney disease, especially in primary care and say endocrine world, start thinking about what we're going to do, start doing things to prevent progression of disease. 38% had CKD3B. So that's between 30 and 45. And then 12% had CKD4. But then that albumin creatinine ratio, and this is interesting to me because and we've seen this in all the SGLT2 trials, et cetera, too, that the average urine albumin to creatinine ratio was 582. So just to give people some perspective, yes, we check it every year in diabetes. Probably people are going to start checking it more in anybody with obesity, any type of metabolic syndrome type stuff, because there's still that risk of kidney disease. We don't want to see so abnormal. Moderately elevated albumin, that's the canary in the coal mine, is like 30 to 300, and 29% of the people in this trial had that. 68% had between 300 and 5,000. I mean, that's significantly elevated albuminuria. I mean, that's like nephrology levels. We're doing everything we can to protect their kidneys at that level. And our department has a pretty high selection bias for these sick patients who have type 2 diabetes, kidney disease, and heart disease. And either we as a society are doing a lot better job at protecting the kidneys, or I'm just not seeing that level because I don't have that many patients with that degree of protein in the urine. Do you?
That's a lot. I don't, I see it more the lower, mildly elevated.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, I see a lot, you know, between 300 and or 30 and 300. And
yeah, right.
We're treating it and protecting the kidneys. Anyways, I just thought that was interesting. The average BMI was 32 kilograms per meter squared. Here's another interesting thing, the smoking status. So we all know how bad smoking is for everything ever, but it's particularly bad for the heart. And so while 50% have never smoked, 12% were still currently smoking at the time. And that means the rest had smoked at some point in their lives and had quit, which is awesome that they quit. But just, you know, again, a pretty high risk population here. Now, here's a kicker, I think, unless we're boring people, but the background medication. So this is important. Almost everybody was on one of those ACE inhibitors or ARBs that we talked about that are very much established standard of care for people with diabetes and kidney disease at all. So 95% were on those. 80% were on lipid treatment. So that's like the statins. So we know that those reduce risk of heart attacks and there's probably some kidney benefits there. Interestingly, from a diabetes, a sugar perspective, 61% were actually already on insulin. And there may be some interesting sub-analysis data that I don't know about from this to see how many people were able to get off of insulin. But only 16% at this time in this trial were on an SGLT2 inhibitor. And that's a big deal when we get to the end results when they start splitting hairs, because for anybody out there, so empagliflozin, which is the brand of Jardiance, dapagliflozin, which is the brand of Farxiga, canagliflozin, the brand is called Invokana. These are the medications that were originally developed for type 2 diabetes because they trick your kidneys into peeing out sugar. So they help you, you know, reduce your sugars. You got a little bit of weight benefit, blood pressure benefit. But when they were studied to make sure they were safe for the heart and then ultimately the kidneys, they turned out to have these really dramatic benefits for heart death, specifically if you had a high risk for heart failure and kidney disease progression. And again, going back to that whole heart-kidney connection, when you have heart disease, kidney disease, heart failure, that's a big, bad, you know, milieu of stuff working against you. And so those SGLT2 inhibitors are really, really important, and they have become very much standard of care for these types of patients for sure.
Yeah. And it's just the timing of the trial. I mean, again, this only goes up to 1 milligram. We have 2 milligrams now. Most everybody at this stage, if they were going into this trial, should be on a SGLT2 inhibitor, but that we didn't have the data as much when this trial started, as far as I understand.
So we'll keep that in mind. But again, a lot of these are just to make sure they're safe. Like the old Mark Hyman, functional medicine people think that it's somehow bad for the kidneys. So really these are safety trials and we hope that there's benefit, right? Especially when we start seeing all the earlier trials suggesting maybe some benefits. So go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say it was placebo injections versus 1 milligram of semaglutide.
They randomized all these people 1-to-1. And like I said, you know, there are a lot of patients in this trial, and they randomized them 1-to-1. And it was an 8-week dose escalation pending, you know, tolerance. So they could slow it down if they needed to, but they start with 0.25 milligrams weekly, just like we do in real life. For a month, then up to 0.5 milligrams weekly, and then it's 1 milligram sub-Q weekly. And yeah, that's what we had when the Ozempic was first approved for type 2 diabetes. Then they eventually approved the 2 milligram dose and, of course, the 2.4 milligram dose known as Wegovy for obesity, regardless of diabetes. And what they were looking at, the primary outcomes in this big trial that you'll hear about, they described major kidney disease events. And so that could include either the onset of kidney failure by like needing dialysis, a transplant, or just having that filtration rate less than 15, or a sustained reduction in that GFR by 50%, or dying from cardiorenal disease. And I also think that's an important one to keep in mind as to what was driving what we talk about at the end. They had some secondary outcomes they looked at, just the slope of GFR decline, MACE, which we've talked a lot about before because a lot of these trials are cardiovascular event trials. So MACE stands for major adverse cardiovascular events, non-fatal heart attack, non-fatal stroke, or death from cardiovascular disease. And then, of course, death from any cause. Those were what they were looking at. And then we'll go into the results.
Yeah, let's get into the results, because I think, you know, people are probably asking, well, is it just the weight loss from these medicines? Again, this is 1 milligram. It's not the high dose of semaglutide.
In type 2 diabetes, remember, there's not as much weight reduction. So actually, since you brought that up.
And in men, too. Potentially men, too.
Yeah,
and which
is mostly men. I will bring that up. So the first thing, now, this trial was stopped after a median follow-up of 3.5 years because the interim analysis showed such statistically significant benefit for people that it would have been unethical to keep randomizing people to placebo. So that's why they stopped these early, by the way. So 3.5 years, but what they did was they looked at weight change at 104 weeks, so 2 years, and the difference in weight was only 4 kilograms more than placebo. It was like basically 5.5 to 6% weight reduction versus 1 to 1.5. So we've talked a lot about the high doses and treating obesity and our goals of much more than 5% weight reduction to really treat these issues, 10% or more to reduce the risk of heart attacks, strokes, et cetera. And so that was not the case. I mean, they certainly had better weight reduction, but only 4 kilograms more than placebo. So the bottom line, the results overall, the first major kidney event. So like I said, the hazard ratio was 0.76. That means we have to talk about statistics because I don't think we talk enough about that. This is a relative risk reduction of 24% for the first major kidney event. It was a relative risk reduction of 29% for death from cardiovascular disease. And these are all statistically significant, by the way. And then for very, very specific kidney events, it was a reduction of 21%. The GFR slope was separated, but it was pretty stable. There was a 20% relative risk reduction of death across the board from all causes. And that was also statistically significant.
Yeah, I mean, so relative is just compared to that other group. So when you think about relative, it's always just relative, right? As opposed to people will say, no, we need to look at absolute risk reduction. And I mean, that's fine, but I think the relative risk reduction is important as well.
Yeah. And it does put into context though. So when we talk about like number needed to treat, like, do we have to give 1,000 people these expensive meds to get benefit? That is where, you know, looking at absolute risk reduction is important. So that said, the absolute risks for major kidney events, again, that first group was a difference of about 4.5%. So over 23% in the placebo group suffered one of those major kidney events compared to about 18.5% for the semaglutide group. That's a pretty high rate of events. But again, these are combined heart and kidney things, right?
And high risk people reason they also pick these types of people is because it's not that they want to see events, but they know they're going to see events. So if you're going to see a reduction, you're going to see it in these people. Mm-hmm. As if you got really low risk people, you're not going to see these events, and then you're not going to see any difference between the two groups. Right. So that's why, you know, it's another reason why they get these very high risk people. Because if it's going to change anything, it's going to be in these folks.
Yeah. And that, you know, that's also going to bring us back to a discussion on who should be getting these really expensive meds, because you kind of just answered that question to some degree. But again, if they were cheap, it wouldn't matter. Okay. So 50% reduction in the decline of kidney filtration rate was about a 3% absolute reduction. So 12% in the placebo group, 9% in the semaglutide group. Kidney failure was only a difference of 6 versus 5%. And interestingly, dying of very kidney-specific disease was the same. It was 0.3% in both groups. So really not that many people died of kidney-specific events. But the big money, again, a lot of it's driven by cardiovascular death,
cardiovascular,
with my Michigan Chicago accent, cardiovascular death was almost 15% in placebo group versus a little over 12% in the semaglutide group. So 2.5% absolute risk reduction of cardiovascular death, and then about a 3% difference, kind of similar numbers just for overall death.
Yeah, these are cardiometabolic drugs, and the weight loss, I mean, that's not a ton of weight loss. There's clearly something going on with these drugs. I think, I mean, some people still be like, well, there's a little bit of weight loss that can help.
Well, and it might be.
Maybe a tiny little bit, but there's something else about these medicines
but it is improving their sugars. They're increasing their exercise more, all this stuff.
It's hitting a lot of things.
Here's the nuance. So, you know, we're not going to get into all the splitting of the hairs with people. But here is the little nuance. When they split it up into those 16% of people that were getting medications like Jardiance, Farxiga, and Vokana, the primary outcome of that benefit was seen essentially only in those who were not on those medicines.
But there was such a small amount of people
like no movement of the needle. And in fact, the little needle was actually going the other
favored
direction.
Placebo.
But now, that doesn't matter because it's so small. There were 275 people in each arm for those who are on an SGLT2 inhibitor. But I think that's a pretty significant little hypothesis generating nugget out of this trial.
I mean, basically what everybody's saying is that like now we need a trial that shows people on both of on background SGLT2 inhibition plus or minus, because we've established that the SGLT2 inhibitors are they need to be on those things. Mm-hmm. Now we need to run the same type of trial. It's just these things are expensive.
Where's the money going
to
come from? Like all the big pharma companies almost have to get together and just work together and say,
they're not
going to
do that.
All right. Well, we're screwed.
That's
kind of why, but then we get in the argument of, well, we don't want big government doing everything. It's amazing how people will argue both ways, right? So the people who don't want big government involved, they don't want big pharma involved either. Well, right. It's government that does the funding for the non-pharma trials. I don't know what anybody wants us to do, but.
I don't know. I'm sure Lilly's also looking at this for tirzepatide. So it might be that we have future trials on, it's not going to be semaglutide. It's going to be a different type of GLP-1 mm-hmm. agonist. I assume that they're going to probably answer, or at least get close to the answer. I think this comes down to clinical, you know, just understanding clinically what we should do with somebody. I'm biased in that I see a lot of obesity, and I think most people would benefit from these GLP-1 medicines. The thing is though, like, is there harm from doing both of them? There's harm. I know it's expensive because you're going to use two branded drugs that are just extremely expensive to use either one of them. They're both expensive. But most of our patients that have cardiometabolic renal disease have some sort of obesity. But if they don't, for some reason, maybe there's a little bit more end stage and losing weight. In fact, this would be where probably we're going to stick with the SGLT2 inhibitors. But to me, I'm like, if somebody has obesity and all these other things, it's GLP-1 or GTFO.
It depends. I don't know. So we'll circle back and think about that in discussion. But you did mention that, the safety of everything, right? And we talked about at the beginning that these trials are primarily to make sure they're safe. Because Mark Hyman is telling everyone, and all the functional medicine docs are telling everyone that they're dangerous, right? So serious adverse events. So serious adverse events. Of course, that includes all the benefits that we just talked about. So 54% of the placebo group had some sort of serious adverse event versus only 50% in the semaglutide group. And for discontinuation, I think this is interesting. Adverse events leading to discontinuation of the trial. This is really where you see who tolerates these medications well. It was 12% in placebo and 13% in semaglutide group. We've talked about there has been signal of concern of worsening eye disease or retinopathy in people with pretty bad type 2 diabetes who get semaglutide specifically. The thought historically is that maybe we're almost improving blood sugars too rapidly because that can exacerbate those microvascular diseases I talked about, like eye disease, neuropathy, et cetera. But in this trial, there was no difference. And these are huge, huge high-risk
trials. That's good to see. Like, I don't understand. Mm-hmm. If we have these huge numbers for long periods of time, highly powered studies, and this one, as opposed to the SELECT trial, which we've talked about, which was pretty much the same size, did not have type 2 diabetes. So this one does have type 2 diabetes, and people on insulin, not extremely severely uncontrolled, but said around 8% as opposed to over 10%, which is probably where we should start being concerned about about some of those rapid glycemic changes. Mm-hmm. But that's reassuring to me.
Yeah, as a I think so
practitioner.
Too. I don't know. Heart failure events, 9.5% in placebo versus 7.5% in semaglutide. I mean, that kind of goes to some of the recent trials of that we talked about of semaglutide in people with type 2 diabetes and heart failure, or just heart failure without type 2 diabetes. You know, so certainly benefit in weight reduction and all the other parameters there. There was no difference in serious gastrointestinal events. So we're talking, you know, those intestinal obstructions, gastroparesis, stomach paralysis that everyone says
should be found in this huge trial. There were almost 3,500 patients overall with 17, over 1,700 in each group. And with the incidence of gastroparesis, what, about 0.1? It's something around 0.5 to 0.1% incidence. We should pop up in somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it wasn't different between placebo. There was, this is interesting. So acute gallbladder disease. So we've talked about how meta-analyses of all these trials do show a small but statistically real increase in like gallstones and gallbladder disease.
We see this clinically.
And this is true, but it's still low percent. It's you know, it's like 1.some% versus 0.something in the meta-analyses. Well, this is interesting because it was 1.8 in semaglutide versus 2.2 in placebo in this trial. So that's good. It was 1% each for liver issues and 0.6 versus 0.4. So a tick numerically higher for pancreatitis, but not really, not statistically, not a real concern. So, yeah. You know, safety is a big deal in this.
I guess the only thing I would say is that low amounts of weight loss, relatively low doses of the stuff compared to what people are cranking up now, may have, that may be a partly a reason for the difference in gallbladder. Not many people lost that much weight. I think it's very possible there's a small degree of action on this, specifically on the gallbladder when it comes to these medicines. But I really think it's the rapid weight loss that's going on that's forming the stones and then causing the disease, as opposed to just specifically something about the medicines.
Yeah. Well, and that makes sense, right? I mean, because we've always known that back in the day, we don't seem to do this anymore, but back in the day, the surgeons and everyone used to put people on medication to help Actigal to prevent that. I don't see or hear that much anymore.
We've talked about it in our obesity groups. It's just what we do. I mean, what I did for our protocols is like, if people are losing faster than 1%, that's where you see it. 1% average body weight per week, the risk starts going up. So like we try to, and any people do this intuitively, they should be doing this. They shouldn't just keep cranking them up. Even if they're losing just rapid amounts of weight, you should make sure like, hey, let's hold on this dose before going up. Although insurances may make you go up. So it really depends on them too. But, we try to make sure that we don't titrate up if rapidly losing weight. And 1%, by the way, some people think of rapid weight loss as like, I don't know. I think 1%. So if you're 300 pounds, 1% is 3 pounds. So if you're going at like 6 pounds a week, you know, getting 2%, you're probably going a little bit too fast. But
yeah,
some of that's water weight in the beginning.
I was going to say, yeah, that's we have our stories for that. But I don't know. I mean, that this is, so now we can kind of circle back and say, well, we can debate the cost effectiveness of this. You know, we had that discussion with the endoscopic gastroenterologist who does the endoscopic gastroplasties, and how there was the trial showing that that's far more cost effective than a patient with obesity and no obesity related disease, especially type 2 diabetes, heart disease, kidney disease, and that, you know, the cost of the Ozempic, Wegovy, whatever would have to be like cut in a third or fourth, you know what I mean? To be cost effective compared to it, like $3,000 a year instead of, you know, whatever, $12,000 a year. So, you know, I'm a big advocate for trying to at least support policy, insurance coverage, whatever it is, for using these medications, being better stewards of using these medications between being patients and clinicians, and using them for those who get the most bang for the buck, a little bit literally speaking, you know. So if you have obesity, yes, these medications really work. If you have obesity with type 2 diabetes, pre-diabetes, metabolic syndrome, they are certainly the most preferable medications because they're going to really reduce your risk of progression. If you have type 2 diabetes and you have heart disease, or you have these other, you know, kidney disease, they're really, really important. I think the SGLT2 inhibitors are absolutely a priority at this point in those who have, especially if you have heart failure or kidney disease. Now, if patients are listening to this, these are the nuances that the doctors have to consider with you and think about these cost effectiveness issues. I mean, but technically, if they were cheap, yeah, everyone who's struggling would probably be getting these, but they're not for right now. They are expensive. We don't have enough for everybody. And the people who have the highest severity of disease are the ones who really should be getting priority for these medications for the time being. And this is a perfect population. You know, let's say a person couldn't get an SGLT2 inhibitor in this exact type of person. Well, they sure as heck better be on this. But the other problem is these patients in this study should be on semaglutide or one of its competitors for a whole variety of other reasons to reduce
risk of glycemic
for the glycemic benefits, for other obesity related benefits, for reducing the risk of sleep apnea, and combined with SGLT2 inhibitors. I mean, that is really a pretty basic staple of most endocrinologists treating obesity, diabetes, especially with any complications, is some sort of GLP-1 receptor agonist, or now tirzepatide, with an SGLT2 inhibitor, because we get so many good benefits, really no risks, and the risks are easily mitigated compared to not doing them. The biggest issue is the cost, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think we talked about this before. There was an article that came out showing the manufacturing cost of that. It's really just like $5 a week it costs to make the semaglutide dose. And I don't know. I'm kind of just sick. I'm sick of it all, because it's like, how much money do these big pharma companies need to make?
Well, they have to pay for the commercials in the United States.
Yeah,
that's a lot of money. So
I don't know. I'm like, and everybody's blaming the doctors for making all the money. It's like, we don't make the money from these people. We don't, like, we specifically don't take the money. But I'm sitting here like,
I get lunch. So if you look at my Sunshine Act, like Jillian did, yeah, I definitely allow my pharma people to bring in lunch for my staff and bring us samples and materials for patients, but they're not paying us for it. It's it does add up to a few $100, but
there's no free lunch. That's what they said.
Yeah, not thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that they do pay some doctors, but those are still academic educational efforts. But it just blows my mind how much they must spend on commercials. We could do a whole podcast episode on that. I'll do my soapbox on that.
Well, I want to, it would be nice to get some sort of PBM insurance expert. You know, I know Bernie Sanders is kind of going after these folks, and people are like, well, no, these places need to make this much money, so they're incentivized to make these new drugs. We're the ones. But it's like, then why are other countries subsidized and getting these things for $100 at the same, it's literally the same stuff? I don't like it.
They don't have, I don't know about this gets so complicated, but those other countries don't have those PBM middlemen people, right? And we have the dysfunctional insurance system. And again, here, the pharma companies have to pay for all their commercials that cost millions and millions of dollars all the time.
I can't believe that they're even promoting Wegovy and Zepbound. Like, you don't need a commercial. The stuff is flying off. Please, if I know that, and in fact, I know Lilly and Novo are listening to this, because I know because they come up to me at conferences and say, I love your podcast. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. You're kind of a bigwig in these companies. Listen, don't make a commercial about Zepbound. Don't make a commercial about Wegovy. You don't need to. You want to know why? TikTok, Instagram, Reddit, everybody's South Park. We did our episode and so everybody's talking about it. You don't need to do any advertising. So shut off all these marketing. You could probably even, I hate to say this because I know we have some reps listening to, you don't even need to pay the reps, because guess what? The stuff's going to sell itself.
Yeah.
You could save yourself a lot of money and then give it back, lower the cost of the drug, and give it back to the patients that actually need it, who are suffering, and also take all those marketing dollars and put it into more factories so we can actually have a supply for our patients, please.
Yeah.
You can tell that we're very frustrated because everybody's, yeah, they're like, you guys are big pharma shows. Like, I don't even make money. These places are laughing their way to the bank. Lilly's going to be a $1 trillion company here soon, just printing money. Novo's got more money than the whole country of Denmark or whatever.
And now the bullshit compounding people are making all the money, and that's what you want to try to get into now.
Yeah, because I'm kind of sick of it, because it's like, well, whatever. Like, you can't even make enough of it. Let's, whatever. Just like, someone's got to do something about it, because otherwise the patients are just yelling at us, and it's like, I can't procure this stuff.
Well, and then, unless you do compounding, and then you really will be making money from pharma, but it's your own pharma.
But
that's even more of a conflict of interest.
Yeah, but me personally, I wouldn't. So other places, there are companies out there that like make money off of the compounded version. And honestly, here's the way that I would do it. Anybody can listen, because I am very transparent. The way that I would do it is I would show you exactly how much it costs. Because the way that you have to, you can connect with these compounding pharmacies, and then you can charge whatever you want, and then the compounding pharmacies will ship it out for you, and you can pad the amount and basically say, okay, so the semaglutide costs $200, but it costs the provider $100 or $150. I'm just making up numbers right now. So then you can actually make money off of it. I wouldn't.
That's unethical. So it's ironic, though, that everyone thinks we get paid for prescribing big pharma, but the people prescribing compounded medicines literally do.
Many of them then. I don't know who doesn't, but I'm telling you the way that I would do it, and I think the way that would be ethical is like, no, I don't want to make money from this thing, because I don't want it to seem like I'm purposely prescribing this just to make more money. Here's the cost that it costs me. Here's what it is. Like, I need to at least cover those costs. I only want this person to pay me for my services of helping them through their journey. That's the way that I would do it. And the way that I would do it also is I would personally ensure the sterility and certificates of analysis all the way through the supply chain. And that's tough to do. There are places that are trying to figure out how to do that. Because right now you apparently you have a decent supply. Wegovy is coming back supply at the lower doses, but like Zepbound, it's like people are driving 3 to 4 hours to go get.
Yeah. But that's supply. Also, that goes back to who should be getting these medications. If these commercial online enterprises are just prescribing them to people with BMIs of 30, just because their insurance covers it and they don't actually have any severity of disease, then it's a waste.
Well, the problem is the FDA approves it for those. And so then you got people that have been struggling with their weight, and they're like, well, you're not going to give it to me. Honestly, if somebody came to you with a 30 BMI and said, I've been struggling with my weight, they're starkly metabolically healthy. Would you tell them no?
You wouldn't say no. That's, you know, you're so full of shit.
Prescribed. No, I already saw a prescription.
Nope. I talk about the more appropriate medications.
Show me your numbers. They showed me scripture.
Phenermine, topiramate, Q-cimic, all these other. I talk about these other medications that they might benefit from.
Dr. Dusky, phentermine gave me anxiety.
Well, that's different.
Bupropion gave me headaches and hypertension.
Can I have some semaglutide?
Nope, you're 30 BMI, starkly healthy.
They've already tried it, though. You're fine. Okay, little brother. Back in the day, we used to get in fights with these older like quacks. Remember when you were resident?
But they were giving out phentermine to everybody.
Yeah, they used to do just phentermine high doses. They would get paid for doing that too. They would sell phentermine somehow.
Right,
and
out
that's
of their
a
office.
So that's the same as the compounding.
Apparently, it's not a stuff. It's not a stuff. I don't know. This is where we need to get an expert on, because like
a lawyer.
But there are a lot of people talking about Stark laws being kind of nonsense too, because they're impeding some of the the ways that could incentivize in good ways. So when you make all these regulations, you're trying to get the bad players, but instead you actually impede the good players that could do more good. It's really interesting thinking about it. Like because of the ACA, Affordable Care Act, they made it so where doctors can't even own hospitals anymore. And the outcomes in doctor-physician-owned hospitals is slightly better than these big corporate
entities
that don't even care about patients. They just care about their bottom lines, let's be honest.
Yeah.
So interesting. So there's actually Atlas MD. We should get Atlas MD on here. This guy, Josh.
Is that your compounding friend that you're trying to...
No. This is a different. They're like a really big direct pay, direct primary care type of practice, and they get the drugs at like very, very low cost. Not semaglutide, but like any drug, and they basically sell it at wholesale prices from their office. So they're saying what I would say. It's like, no, let's cut out all these middlemen. Let's just cut them out. We can just reduce the cost and just sell them as for what they are, as opposed to...
Is that what Mark Cuban does?
He cut out PBMs. That's their big thing. He's revolutionizing the way this is going to work, because like you start cutting out these middlemen that are increasing costs of all these drugs. I'm just so sick of it. I'm so cynical and disenfranchised. I'm just like, no, this shouldn't be like breaking the banks of patients. It's just like,
it goes back to the, I still think that, you know, this direct to consumer marketing. So you were talking about just these medications don't need commercials. No medications need commercials to patients.
None.
We don't need patients coming in asking about medicines. We need to make sure doctors have the time and the capability to continue their medical education, and not necessarily by drug reps, but at conferences and time to read the studies that come out. I will say, though, one of my arguments against banning all drug reps is because if you don't at least open up to the idea of some of the new medications...
Why don't we just have the medical science liaisons then?
Well, that's...
They're awesome.
Yeah, they are.
Sorry, drug reps. I'm sorry, but I love my medical science liaisons.
Yeah, they're awesome.
They know the studies very well, and they're not... They don't get into the commercial stuff. It's a separate, and I don't know.
Well,
I don't know if every company does that.
The thing I like about the reps is that, you know, they bring us the samples.
They bring you Chipotle.
They bring me Chipotle. We don't do Chipotle. They bring us the samples, patient supplies. They have some finger on the pulse of like the what is available at different pharmacies and whatnot, and you know, other patient materials. But you're right. I mean, there's not a need to spend money on the marketing. The doctors need to be educated. Patients don't need to be marketed towards. That drives me insane that we have that in the United States and nowhere else other than, is it New Zealand? Is that the only other
place? I don't know.
It's one other. Anyways, I forgot.
Yeah, get rid of them.
I mean, I went crazy when I saw during the Super Bowl a commercial for Dexcom. My patients with type 1 diabetes who desperately need, talk about standard of care, they need to have a continuous glucose monitor. People without diabetes do not need a continuous glucose monitor like Peter Attia says. If we finally got back to Peter Attia. But they had a huge commercial
costing up in every single podcast.
Millions and millions of dollars with, what was it, the dude? Who's the guy that was... famous singer guy with type 1 diabetes. They're paying him, you know, and he was their spokesperson on the commercial during the Super Bowl.
Jonas Brothers?
Yeah. I was so mad. I was like, are you kidding me? My patients with type 1 diabetes sometimes can't even get these, and now you're spending millions and millions of dollars to market it?
If you just sold them at what they, you know, a little bit more than what they cost, then you don't even have to use insurance and make it all bloated. You know what I mean?
God,
just buy it for 300, a few hundred, but like if you don't have an indication, just a few $100, whatever it is, that would be fine. I'm okay with that. But if we shouldn't be using insurance for those who don't have an indication, we went really off the, we were supposed to be talking about the flow trial. That's fine.
We
though.
Can split like, it in two.
Nah, that's fine.
Or one we'll in just, two.
Anyway, we do need to get someone that's an expert at the PBMs and insurances, because the stuff boggles my mind about how messed up our current system is. So,
well, if anybody knows, you know, people
send them
who
our
are
way.
Not
email
unbiased,
us, please.
Or we can have a debate, something. I don't know. We need some education because nobody seems to know what the hell's going on. It drives me insane.
Yeah. Please send us email, Spencer at Dr. Spencer, drspencer.com. That's fine.
You just got blown up.
Instagram us, whatever.
Yeah.
We're everywhere. Tweet us. Tweeters.
Also, it turns out that I have been made aware that I have some sort of like impatient conversational ADD. So I tried not to talk over you this time.
No, I thought it was just a software glitch.
It used to be. Apparently when we were sitting next to each other, I was worse.
Well, that's just because you're an asshole.
I'll try not to be. Sorry.
Oh, God. All right. Here's our outro. Send this to a friend. I don't even know. Send it to somebody. Give us a good review, too.
Please.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.